on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is Five Live.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Wimbledon 2009. It's men's semi-finals day. We're up on the roof. Mark Kermode is here, reprising his much-loved role here at Wimbledon. How are you doing, Doctor?
I think it's going very well this year, the Wimbledon.
Isn't it?
Apparently so, yes.
It's going very well.
Many goals scored, and the roof has been going backwards and forwards.
That's Hemman Hill over there. That's court
number
one. Then centre court and all the other courts.
Okay.
And up on the roof, Jonathan Overend and Michael Stieg. Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Hi, Simon.
Hi, Simon.
Now, just stay here because Mark won't get these, but since last week, everyone's been sending in movie titles with a vaguely tennis adapted theme, and they're all very good if you know about the tennis players involved, and Mark clearly won't.
Well, shall we see if Mark laughs?
Okay, let's see if Mark laughs genuinely. Thanks very much indeed for these coming in. Lots of people saying, who's this? Is Joe Jones, Annabelle Croft, Tomb Raider.
Nice.
Do you like that one? Kevin and Fred Perry go large. Well, the only point in keeping you here is that you both...
Great! Unbelievable!
I do get it. It's not funny, but I do get it.
The name of the Rose Wall, I quite like. Tracy Austin Powers. That's quite good.
Lost again.
Gula Gong with the Wind. This is... Who's this? This is from B. Collins.
That's better.
Lilo and Stieg.
Oh, that's very nice.
You like that one,
I love that one. Yeah, I love Lilo.
Now, this is good, bearing in mind what's coming out, what is imminent. Adam Mira, Harry Potter and the Tommy Haasblood Prince. Do you like that?
No.
Chippy German again. Hewitt, A Lovely War. Suggested
Roberta Vinci Code.
Yeah, you have to explain Roberta Vinci now.
She's a tennis player.
Great, thanks very much.
That was great, the way that detail was just filled in so seamlessly.
Stuart in Cheltenham, Connors the Barbarian, Anna Kournikova and her sisters.
Yeah, I get that, because they're tennis players. I can do it as well.
The Battleship Petrova.
Oh, Mark should come up with one. Come on, just be creative.
The Assassination of the Jeremy Bates by the Coward Bjorn Borg. Do you like that one?
I've got one.
Go on.
Wimbledon. Oh, no, that already was a movie.
Interview with an Umpire. That's quite good.
Do you have umpires in tennis? Isn't that cricket?
Yes, both.
What, the people who umpire for cricket umpire for tennis as
well? Yes, that's right. They do the same thing. One in the morning, one in the afternoon. Death in tennis, I quite like, thanks
to
Susan.
It's not a very specialist pursuit.
This is good. Julian Owen in Bristol. The cook, the thief, his wife and Rod Laver. Now that is class. That is class.
Even got a smile off Mark for that one.
It did. And Paul Wade, thank you, Paul. Dear Guy and Madge, The Chronicles of Roddick. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You like that?
Well, he's excited.
Sampras in Seattle. And No Country for Old Henman. Now that is good.
But is that, no, that
it's
is
worth
good.
A nod.
Yeah, but it's not as good as Rod Laver.
You like that one?
That was the best.
Is that your favourite? So our winner,
the thief, his wife and Rod Laver was
the winner of Centre Court. No, that's not right, is it? Just the winner. Julian Owen, the cook, the thief, his wife and
Rod Laver.
That'll do. Unless you can do better, mayo at bbc.co.uk. I'm so glad I kept hold of you, Michael, for that entertaining item that we were running. So let's do the box office top 10. We have.
Can we just say, before we even do 9 and 7, we're passing over Blood, Last Vampire, I Have to See This Weekend, New York.
I'll tell you about that when we get there.
Oh, fine, okay.
Okay, number 10 is Sunshine Cleaning.
It was moved for my film of the week last week, and I liked it a lot more than most people. And many people said the problem with it was it was from the producers of Little Miss Sunshine, and therefore was just Little Miss Sunshine. But I didn't like Little Miss Sunshine very much. I did like Sunshine Cleaning, although I could have quite easily gone in with an editor and taken out Alan Arkin's bit as the grumpy old curmudgeonly bloke who forms a relationship with the strange child, because that is the bit that clearly the producer said, yeah, if you've got sunshine in the title, you do need to have Alan Arkin and a kid.
Number 9 is New York.
Go on.
What?
Well, tell me what it is.
Do you not know anything about it? It's obviously the 2009 Bollywood film directed by Kabir Khan.
Ah, now tell me, is it any good?
I can only tell you it's the 2009 Bollywood film directed by Kabir Khan.
Can we throw it open to the listeners?
Yes, well, you can if you wish.
No, we, Simon, as a joint enterprise. If you've seen New York, let us know.
Okay, so New York's at number 9, but Mark hasn't seen it. Angel and Demons at number 8.
Angels and Demons. Angel and Demons, presumably, is the shorter version. There's only one angel and several demons. It is still intergalactically terrible, but it is funnier than The Da Vinci Code. Because do you think we're now far enough down the line to be able to talk about the thing that happens at the end that I wasn't...
No, I don't think so.
Can there be anybody who hasn't yet found out what happens at the end? Have you seen Angels and Demons?
Well, at the end of Angels and Demons?
Do you know what happens at the end of Angels
Jonathan,
and Demons?
Jonathan, you might notice, being a radio man, that Jonathan's taking his
Andy Roddick saw that film twice during the French Open.
But didn't understand it the first time?
No.
Okay.
Is that why he went the second time?
All right. Can I just say to anyone who's listening, if you don't want to know what happens in the end, just turn the volume down for like 20 seconds, okay? I can't not... I mean, it's been months now I haven't talked about this.
Michael, have you seen... he hasn't got his headphones on either. Have you seen Angels and Demons?
No.
No. Would you like to know what happens at the end?
No.
Okay.
Can we move on?
Do I say this when you're doing your tennis stuff? Do I say, I don't care what's happening with that bloke and the ball and the umpire stuff? No, I don't want to know.
We don't know the end of the tennis match.
Yeah, we do. One
of
them will win. The other one will shake their hand over the thing. Everyone will cheer. It'll all be fine. It'll all happen again in a year's time.
What's the next one?
Okay.
What happens at the end of Angels and Demons?
I can't tell you now because I'm being told by...
If Hersteek says no, then you can't do it.
Yeah, so I can't say.
To do it in front
exactly.
Of
almost as rude as you referring to him as a humourless German just about 5 seconds ago.
Chippy German.
Chippy, I see. Fine.
That's his role. That's the role that he plays in the commentary box. Chippy German sits at the end, makes chippy comments. Isn't it?
Okay.
So tomorrow, you're going to get your sticky toffee pudding, mate.
You promised me for the last 4 days.
Oh, okay, no, I'll do it on Sunday. We'll do it on finals day.
Okay.
Right. I feel like I've wandered into something that I really am slightly out of my depth with.
Blood the Last Vampires at 7.
Yeah, that's the one I've got to catch up over the weekend, okay. As I told you before.
Terminator Salvation at 6.
Just rubbish. There's a piece in The Guardian today about... go on, make the joke. Oh, you only ever read The Guardian. No, I did it for you. About why modern blockbusters are rubbish. And they were quoting somebody who seemed to me to be talking about Terminator Salvation, and it was complaining about stars and things like that. But no, it is just absolutely scriptless dirge from beginning to end, and they've turned the Terminator stuff into an action franchise, which it was never meant to be, and they've aimed it at a 12-year-old audience, which it was never meant to be, and it's just head-bangingly bad.
There was a splendid moment when we were coming back from Edinburgh where I handed Mark a copy of the Daily Telegraph to read. And he looked at it as though he'd never seen it before in his life. Only being a Guardian reader, Jonathan, you understand. So he said, "What do I do? What do I do with this?"
I didn't say, what do I do with it?
Look at the size of it. He'd never seen a newspaper so big. He thought everything
so
came in the Berlin
of Liz Hurley
size.
In it. It was amazing.
Quite extraordinary. Night at the Museum 2 is at 5.
Night at the Museum 1 was already overstating the case. Night at the Museum 2 is just, you know, simply the numbers add up in terms of the box office, which we'll come to as far as Ice Age 3 is concerned. And Ricky Gervais is on the poster, but hardly in the film.
My Sister's Keeper's at 4.
Cameron Diaz does ditzy comedy roles. She shouldn't do serious roles about terrible terminal illnesses because she's not very good at them.
Year 1 at 3.
Just so much less funny than the Monty Python movies, which the people who made it have clearly seen. There is a moment in it when you think that one of the characters is going to say, Fwee Wodwick. And it's just... it's funny... I've decided the poster is funnier than the film. The poster is Jack Black and Michael Cera standing there with the furry loincloths on. And actually, it went past me on a bus the other day, and I sort of briefly, the edge of my mouth went up slightly in a bit of a smile, and then I remembered what the film was like, and then the smile went. But that was more than the film itself did. It's just not funny.
The Hangover's at 2?
Not funny.
Well, everyone else thinks it's funny.
No, they don't.
They do.
They don't.
Everyone else
is going to see it. Everyone else is coming away disappointed, and everyone else is going home, and everyone's saying, did you see The Hangover? Yeah, what was it like?
No, they all think it's better than
no,
you.
No, they don't. They don't. They're all coming out. All those critics say, oh, yeah, it's brilliant. It's actually reinventing the laddie, you know, let's go to Las Vegas and get drunk for a weekend thing. But actually, what their inner souls are saying is, yeah.
So you have this gift of seeing everyone's inner soul
no,
now,
but it's
do
just
you?
True. That's I was in that screening room with everyone laughing other than me, and I think that they were faking. I think that there was like an email went round.
Or
saying,
you're
let's
just weird.
See. No, it's nothing. It's not. Have you seen it?
No.
No, well, there we go. I have. It's not funny.
Hence your obligation to see these
things. But I'm not complaining about having to see it, but it's just you're telling me it's funnier than I say it is, but the difference is that I've seen it and not laughed through it, and you haven't seen it.
Transformers Revenge of the Fallen is at number 1. Ben in New Zealand, Marky and Simone. I went to see Transformers yesterday, and I'm still recovering. How can a film that is so silly try to take itself so seriously? I came out of the first one thinking it was all right, but this was just utter nonsense. In the scene towards the end, and I don't rate this as a spoiler, where She Likes Beef is shouting at his parents, go away, run, get out of here now. I felt he was actually screaming at me. To my detriment, I ignored his advice and remained in the film for the ending that was clearly written by a creationist with a twisted sense of humour.
Well, there was again, in that very same piece in the only paper that I read, apparently, there was somebody talking about why is it that Michael Bay, or Damien, as I like to call him, keeps getting paid these staggering amounts of money for making these movies. And they asked some quote, Hollywood insider. They said, you know, why is it that Michael Bay gets money? Because clearly he couldn't direct traffic, and he is, you know, artistically moribund and putrefying in ways that it would be rude to explain. And she said, and this was a direct quote, she said, because he's really good in meetings, and he has great hair. Have you ever seen Michael Bay's hair?
No,
what's he's got
like?
A mullet. He said, so of the two things, right, the two reasons why Michael Bay might get paid, one of them is an outright lie. Because of all the things you could say about Michael Bay, he's got great hair. He's not one of them. Well, he's got the cat flap and the mullet and the head tree. He looks like somebody just walked out of a video by Toto. You keep expecting him going to discover himself down in Africa.
You just spat at me when you were doing that. Please stop salivating when you talk about Michael Bay movies. So Ice Age 3, a big movie for the summer holidays coming out. And I know, I can tell from your body language how you're gearing this one up. Anyway,
you can tell from the fact that I was spitting at you when I was talking about Michael Bay's haircut.
It's a cartoon, it's in 3D. What else do we need to know?
Here's the plot. 378, 624, and therefore 850. Explain to me why that's the plot.
Box office takings would be my guess.
First one took 378 million worldwide in 2002-ish, I think it was. Ice Age The Meltdown, which was theoretically The Meltdown, took 624 million in 2006. So if we project that, that means 850 million for this new one. There is no other reason for it to exist.
That's a pretty good reason.
At least, no, well, fine. As long as we understand from the very outset that when people talk about continuation of the story and returning to characters everyone knows and loves and, you know, expanding things and broadening things out and widening things out, they're not talking about plot, narrative, story, but what they're talking about is finance. They're just talking about... So, effectively, what we could be on the money programme now, OK? We could be reviewing this simply by looking at the money. Well, I will play you a clip just so that you can hear a little bit of what it's meant to sound like. But what narrative there is in the story is some of the characters that you knew before are still walking.
One of the characters?
Oh, mammoths, sloths. Oh, John Leguizamo lisping. I could do an impression of John Leguizamo, but since I spat at you doing Michael Bay, if I do the lisping, you know, John Leguizamo, you'll get rained on. They're walking, and one of them's pregnant, and so there's a maternity-paternity issue going on. The John Leguizamo one finds some eggs buried in the ice, and then it turns out that under the ice there are dinosaurs, which I think explains the anachronistic collision of animals. So I'm not entirely sure that it's based on fact.
Well, dinosaurs came before the animals, didn't they?
Well, they're under the ice now. And anyway, so they fall down under the ice where there's a whole other world. It's sort of like Journey to the Centre of the Earth with dinosaurs. And then another character comes up who's got a voice, which is done by somebody who we know on the show. Here's a clip.
Say something.
Thanks for saving us.
Buck, will you help us find the floppy green thing?
That's not necessary.
Yes, it is.
All right, I'll help you. But I got rules. Rule number one, always listen to Buck. Rule number two, stay in the middle of the trail. Rule number three... He who has gas travels at the back of the pack. Come on then, chop chop.
We should all have our heads examined.
That's rule number four. Now let's go find your friend.
Who's that then?
Well, it sounded like Danny Baker.
That's right, it was. Five Lives' very own Danny Baker is starring in Simon Pegg.
Pretending to be Danny Baker.
Pretending to be Danny Baker.
606 with Simon Pegg, that has a ring to it.
It's one of those things in which, you know, I mean, obviously, my cynicism about it is quite... Because I did say for the first couple of Ice Age movies, it was the death of narrative cinema in that what was happening was it was a completely modular film system, OK?
What does that mean?
It means... that it's completely modular, meaning that all the bits exist modally, right? You know what modal jazz is?
Well, could you just sort of start at the beginning?
Well, yes. I don't want to know
about modal jazz. Just tell me about a film that's fully modular.
No, but funnily enough, that can you just start at the beginning is almost exactly what I would have said was the problem with Ice Age 3. Because the problem with Ice Age 1 and 2 and 3 is you could start at any point. And you could do that sequence.
Is that what modular means?
Modular, yeah, they're modular. They're modes, modules. You can take them out, you can take out the modules, you can replace them in any order, it doesn't make any sense, because there's no narrative thread. So there's the bit with Scrat and the acorn, right? The little thingy going around chasing after the acorn. You could have put that in any of the three films. In this one, there's a little bit of a distraction that some way through stops being interested in the acorn, starts being interested in a girl, ends up being interested in the acorn again. It's just the way it works that game. Modular. Lots of bits of walking. Big, you know, animals walking. Walking along, modular. Can put them in any order you want. Dinosaur chases, dinosaur escapes. Dinosaur chases, dinosaur escapes. People threaten, people in a modular. Doesn't matter what order you do them in. The BBFC's report, which, as usual, is one of the most brilliant bits of film criticism we ever get offered. U certificate, okay? So it is at least being passed for all audiences. Well, and I have to say, yes, in its great defence, unlike Transformers, which has Megan Fox, you know, leaning over a motorbike and therefore making it completely inappropriate for young viewers.
At that moment, you did your put-the-bottom-in-the-air routine.
Can't do Megan Fox.
It looks like you're about to break wind,
actually. No, well, funnily enough, that's almost what I thought as I was watching the film. But at least it doesn't have any of that leeriness. At least it doesn't have sleepy la beef, snoozy la pork in it. At least it doesn't think that what it has to do is satisfy some adolescent 15-year-old. It's just, it's a kid's movie. But they say this is brilliant. It contains scenes of threat, mild comic violence and innuendo, right? Pregnant Ellie is menaced by several predatory dinosaurs whilst in labour, but the characters are rescued by their friends in a moderately intense 10-minute action sequence, OK? Moderately intense, and there is some mild innuendo and my favourite, bottom humour. Okay,
that you are allowed to have. See, then, isn't it?
You are allowed to have moderately intense action, mild innuendo, and bottom humour.
How much bottom humour before you stop being a U and becoming a PG?
I think once it goes from being bottom humour to being Megan Fox, it immediately goes straight up into the 12 certificate. Okay, now, so point number one, it's completely innocuous if you're not bothered by something existing only as a cash cow, but at least a cash cow that's aimed at a younger audience and doesn't necessarily sully its hands by attempting to play to the nuts lads bag audience, which is great. I mean, I assume that no nuts reading teenagers will go and see Ice Age 3. Second problem is it's 3D, and you know that I have this issue with 3D being just an industry way of trying to pretend that piracy is a big problem and we can all solve piracy by all paying more money to go and see 3D movies, and it's an immersive experience and it's great, the whole future is going to be 3D and all these 3D screens have to be paid for, therefore we have to pay the extra money to get the glossy yadda yadda yadda. But in the end, it's an industry thing. It's nothing to do with us, the audience. It's nothing to do with giving you a better viewing experience. Well, I saw Ice Age 3D in 3D, although there are also 2D prints of it, and it was the moment at which I finally thought, okay, that's it, they're really I'm right, this 3D thing is just for nobody's benefit other than the filmmakers. There's just no reason for it to be in 3D at all. The only reason for it to be in 3D is that it has a 3 in the... See, they're calling it Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs, but if you call it Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs 3D, you remind people that it's the third installment in the same way as all those slasher movies in the 1980s, you know, like Friday the 13th 3D, Amityville 3D. You're remembering all of these. Jaws 3D.
Yes.
This time it's personal.
I remember going to
see
that.
Yeah, fine. So all of those, suddenly there was a spate of your third one movies in 3D. There is really no reason for Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs to be 3D. There's one sequence in which they're on the back of, I think it's a pterodactyl, but I'm not entirely biologically sure what it was, because to be honest, all the creatures, they all kind of look cute and cuddly. And if you have young children, there are some cute baby dinosaurs that will make them do that noise. Oh!
What, the dinosaurs or
no, 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 the kids. You know, when kids see other cute, like, baby things, right? And they go, oh! Actually, particularly, you know, younger, oh!
It's a girl thing. I don't think boys do that, make that noise, really.
I don't think you should make those kind of gender distinctions.
Well, I just
because
have.
I think that's you know, that's driving a line between... I think everyone should feel free to do it. But there are some quite cute dinosaurs.
Everyone can feel free to do it. In general, though, it's girls who are going, oh, sweet.
Yeah, well, it is, yeah, but although you...
Right, so you're joining me in the dividing line.
No, I'm not. I'm going to stand on the line of equality. And I could say, you know, young boys and girls alike, when they see the little dinosaurs hatch out the eggs, are able to go, oh, sweet, in 3D. But beyond this pterodactyl flying sequence and the cuddly bit, the whole movie would look essentially exactly the same in 2D, and you wouldn't have to sit there wearing those glasses and coming out thinking, why have I just had to... And the worst thing about it is that because the numbers stack up as they do, you know, I said whatever it was, 3, 2, 4, 6, 50, 8, 50, everyone's going to go, well, look, Ice Age 3 was a 3D hit, therefore everything has to be 3D, and we're going to spend the next 5 years of our life watching 3D movies until Hollywood finally realises that piracy is not going to be solved by this 3D revolution. The 3D revolution isn't going to happen in the way that everyone thinks it is, and actually cinema is designed to be 2D CinemaScope, what, you know, 2, 3, 5, that's the shape of the script. People every now and then they say, oh, let's have odorama, let's have sense around, let's have feel around, let's have, you know, all those things. Doesn't make any difference, we'll all end up back where we started, and can we just move to that point now and stop having us wear the headache inducing glasses?
I missed the feel around. When was that? A movie in feel around?
There was a movie in feel around, yeah. It's, no, I'll tell you what it is. It's a joke from Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, Kentucky Fried Movie,
yes.
When a guy goes to see a film in Feel Around, and he sits there and these arms come out the back of the chair and slap him around the face.
So look, we've got a couple of minutes before the news, so let's hold on to the very well-known new Johnny Depp movie, which
the
I think
Michael Mann film.
Everyone's referring to it as the Johnny Depp film.
The Michael Mann
Squeeze
film.
Something tasteful in before 12:30.
Can we very quickly talk about Am I Black Enough for You?
You can do what you wish.
Okay, really. there's a documentary, a music documentary coming out called Am I Black Enough For You, which is the story of Billy Paul, who is most famous for singing Me and Mrs. Jones.
You could have just said the title without singing it.
Do-do-ba-ba-da.
You really have to stop.
We got it. No, but...
Please stop.
Okay, well, that's what he's famous for doing. I said to you, Billy Paul, do you know Billy Paul? And you pretty much did that.
I didn't sing it.
You did. You were,
I wouldn't
you,
have sung it.
No,
on the
you
rain,
did. You sort of did it in a
Billy
little
Paul,
bit. But Billy
you know
Paul,
that. Yeah, skip a bit.
So he had a moment when he was, you know, incredibly successful as a crossover artist, and immediately after that, he recorded a single called "Am I Black Enough for You," which I have to say I wasn't familiar with, but apparently he is very well known. Schoolie D did a cover version of it. Apparently, did you know about that record?
I did not know about
okay.
the record.
Well, it's a very interesting documentary about his life and about whether what happened after the crossover success of Me and Mrs. Jones by suddenly making this single that was, you know, fairly radical and outspoken, actually derailed what could have been a really big mainstream career. And the documentary is put together in a way in which, on the one hand, you hear this guy singing and he's still performing today and he's still in pretty good shape. I mean, he's, you know, his voice isn't quite what it was, but he's, you know, he's still doing really well. There's a lovely story about him and his wife and about how she stood by him through good times and bad, and it actually ends up being a real sort of, I think, you know, testament to the human spirit. But there's a very interesting conundrum at the middle of it about whether or not it is possible to be a certain kind of star and then release a record that alienates your kind of crossover audience. And I, as somebody who knew very little of this story at all, other than obviously my extremely good impression of Me and Mrs. Jones, which you've now dissed.
Well, it was dissed because that sounds so believable. Yeah, go on.
Well, what would you say then?
Being rude about.
Being rude about. Okay, fine.
Rather than pretend I was from the Bronx.
Yeah, clearly I'm from Barnet rather than the Bronx. We'll carry on that anyway. Anyway, so very interesting story about a guy about whom I didn't know enough, which talks about whether or not, you know, essentially he was, that's, it's kind of an ironic thing that the single is called Am I Black Enough For You? And the question was it actually that what happened after this was that he became too black for the mainstream white audience and therefore didn't have quite the success he had? And the most fascinating part of it is that there's a central disagreement between him and his wife. And he loves the record but understands that perhaps it wasn't the best thing to release, and she feels very differently about it. And it was, I thought it was very well made, very interesting documentary and well worth seeing.
Jerry in Bath, dear Simon and Garfunkel, I'd like to say a big thank you to the good doctor for his sage advice that we'd all come out of the cinema thinking that the new Transformers movie was simply rubbish and not good enough. It prompted me to take my 12-year-old son to go and see it. What a great movie, Simon. Action, a few sexy bits for the dads, even a storyline in the true sense of a movie about trucks that turn into robots that save the world. This is fantasy after all. A proper start-to-finish action film with enough laugh-out-loud moments to fit into the doctor's comedy critique. Excellent, highly recommended, best value film of the year. And keep up the great reviews.
Yeah, may I just say that from a man who included the phrase "a few sexy bits for the dads."
Yes, and he put Megan Fox in brackets in case we hadn't worked that one out.
Megan Fox.
No, it just looks as though you're breaking wind.
I'm sorry. I want that to be the image in the national consciousness whenever Megan Fox is.
Well, we are
comes
filming
up.
This, so you and it'll be up online a bit later on. So if you do go and see Transformers, when you see Megan Fox draped over the motorbike, just remember that actually she's not draping herself so that you admire her short shorts. She's doing it because she's breaking wind.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And then that'll actually be the end of that particular sequence.
That will be the best thing about the Transformers. It is terrible. I mean, it really, and it's so long. It just goes on and on and on.
Thank you very much. And also the various film titles with tennis references, which will be lost on Mark.
Really can't see anything, can you?
No, I'm just disappearing into my box again.
Okay, fine.
Chris in Southampton, The Bjorn Supremacy. We might have had some of these last week. I can't remember.
That's
Kingdom
good.
Of Heaven. A Fish Called Mardy, which works quite well because there's an American tennis player called Mardy Fish. I just have to explain all the jokes here, which kind of, you lose everything.
But the film's called A Fish Called Wanda, and that doesn't work.
And there's a fish called...
Not really.
15 Love, actually.
15, well, yeah, okay.
And Who Framed Roger Federer, down in Norfolk. I think
that we did that have last week, and I did get it last week.
The Englishman Who Went Up a Hill and Came Down a Mound, a reference to Hemman Hill and Murray Mound. anyway.
Nope.
So these completely sailing about 6 feet over Dr. Mark's head.
Yeah.
So let's take another review then, and certainly people want to know how the new Johnny Depp movie is going to be
or
going
the new
down.
Michael Mann film, as it's known to people that know anything at all about cinema. It's always great when you come to the period, you know, the summer blockbuster period, and you're putting up with all these terrible films like the Transformers sequels and the Terminator sequels, and suddenly along comes, I mean, you know, Michael Bay and your Brett Ratners and your McGee, all those people, and there's a proper filmmaker, Michael Mann. Michael Mann, of course, widely regarded by, you know, film fans as one of the best directors. I mean, I think he can be referred to as an auteur, although it sounds like a, you know, pretentious word. I think he is an auteur because you can look at a Michael Mann film and you know it's a Michael Mann film. There's a certain way in which he shoots things. There's the themes which he comes back to again and again and again. They are clearly auteurist works. What's your favourite Michael Mann film?
Heat.
Okay, which is fantastic, right?
Oh, all the way through.
Wonderful piece of work. Manhunter, I think, still stands as one of his best works. I really, really like The Insider because not only is it a great conspiracy thriller, it's also the best cinematic argument for never, ever smoking cigarettes and realising that cigarette companies are indeed in league with the devil. So, you know, very fine heritage on him. Now, probably what promises to be his most publicly popular movie, Public Enemies, which is the story of John Dillinger, famous Depression-era bank robber who had a kind of, you know, Jesse James folk hero status. The story is essentially his career as a bank robber. Christian Bale is the guy who's leading up the newly appointed federal bureau to bring him down. And in the middle of it all is Marianne Cotillard. Now, you remember Marianne Cotillard because she was the person who took the main role in La Vie en Rose, the story of Edith Piaf, which I criticised for the fact that she wasn't allowed to do her own singing in it. They got her to lip-sync to the Edith Piaf records on the grounds they said that nobody could sing like Edith Piaf, and I disagree because I think in the Buddy Holly story, Gary Busey doesn't necessarily sing like Buddy Holly, but he does a brilliant job. In the Doors movie, Val Kilmer, not one of my favourite actors, still the fact that he performs on stage. I thought Marianne Cotillard should have been allowed to perform the Edith Piaf songs. Anyway, she is the hatchet girl with whom John Dillinger falls in love. John Dillinger played by, as you mentioned earlier on, Johnny Depp. Here's a clip.
Hit the road, sport. Keep the tip. You ain't getting other people's hats and coats no more neither.
Why'd you do that?
Because you're with me now.
I don't know anything about you.
I was raised on a farm in Mooresville, Indiana. My mama died when I was 3. My daddy beat the hell out of me because he didn't know no better way to raise me. I like baseball, movies, good clothes, fast cars, whiskey, and you. What else you need to know?
Now, on the plus side, obviously, you know, Michael Mann, proper filmmaker. Johnny Depp, I think, is a very, very fine actor, despite the Pirates of the Caribbean thing, which I think is a bad performance, but I think he is a really great actor. He's a really good physical actor. He's one of the few modern actors who actually understands physical acting in the way of old silent film stars. I mean, he's a great fan of Buster Keaton, obviously, and, you know, there is something about the way in which he tells a story through the way his body moves rather than just what his mouth says, which I think is very, very important. Christian Bale, I'm starting to be slightly concerned about, because having thought that he was a great and intense actor, he's made a couple of duff things recently. Because obviously, you know, obviously the great big action sequels, which we're not even going to mention anymore because they're quite terrible. My problems with Public Enemy are many. The thing to say at the beginning of that, however, is that even Michael Mann making a film that isn't as good as the rest of his Michael Mann of his oeuvre is a lot better than most of the stuff that's in the cinema. So when I say that if you're a Michael Mann fan, you might find Public Enemies disappointing, that's not to say that if you're somebody who's been going to the cinema for the last few weeks and has seen all the dirge and dreck that's out there, you won't think, oh, well, finally, here comes a proper filmmaker, which I think is perhaps why it is that Public Enemies has been getting better reviews than perhaps it deserves. Here are the central problems. The first one is Marianne Cotillard is introduced quite early on as the character with whom Dillinger falls in love. And she's a really powerful screen presence. And Michael Mann's films are all about men. I mean, it's not just because he's called Michael Mann. He makes men's films. He makes films about blokes doing stuff. And he's never been very good at doing female characters. But along comes Marianne Cotillard and takes what's essentially a kind of quite throwaway role and turns it into something that's significant and important. But is then off screen for an awful lot of the movie, leaving you wondering what happened to that character that you were really interested in. So you do this weird thing about you bring somebody in, you give her the role, she does a really good job of it, she's on screen for the length of it, and then suddenly she's off and we're back to the blokes doing their stuff, and you keep thinking, actually, if you had an actress who was less charismatic than she was, this might not have unbalanced the movie. But I really found myself for long sections of the movie thinking, I really rather find out what Marianne Cotillard's character was doing than being with the blokes. The second thing is that Michael Mann essentially makes the same movie again and again and again, which I don't necessarily have a problem with. I mean, Hitchcock made the same movie over and over again. You know, Woody Allen makes the same movie over and over again. I don't necessarily think that people shouldn't remake the same idea. But the central idea at the end of all Michael Mann's films is that there are two blokes locked in a kind of struggle of good and evil, and actually the two sides are indistinguishable. You remember in Heat, the famous coffee shop sequence in Heat? Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, in which they finally on screen together, because of course they weren't on screen together in the Godfather series, because there was never a point in which they were chronologically in the same frame, although they are, you know, they're in the movie together, but they're never in the scene together. So there they are in Heat, and the screen is almost imploding with the fact that you've got these two incredible actors together, but what's important is they're doing that discussion about he's looking at the world from one side, the other guy's looking at the world from the other side, but essentially they're seeing the same thing. And that's sort of the central tenet of an awful lot of Michael Mann's films, is that, you know, blokes and their equals and opposites are in fact part of the same. Well, the problem with it in Public Enemies is that it's kind of not true. It's, yes, on the one hand, you know, Dillinger's the bank robber and Christian Bale's the guy who's heading him down. And what you're not finding is some sort of deep reservoir of, sort of Stygian sameness. What you're actually seeing is they're not really the same character, and they're not really two sides of the same coin, and they're not really that interesting. But you kind of think they ought to be because it's a Michael Mann film, and that's the thesis of all Michael Mann films. And you think that must be the thesis of this film, because if it's not, where's Marianne Cotillard when we need her? So there's a bit of a hole there. And the third thing is that it's filmed with this handheld, very high-definition digital camera, which enables you to get very close and intimate with the actors, which was something that he did brilliantly in Collateral. The problem with it in this case is that there is a strange disjunct between the style, which is very modern, very ultra-modern style, and the period setting. And there were times when it made me think it was kind of like somebody had got Lars von Trier to remake The Untouchables. In a way, for the first time, I had a sense of Michael Mann's style being totally taken away from the subject matter. I mean, he's known for things like Miami Vice and for a particular form of glossy cinema, but he's also somebody who's, you know, who has pushed digital technology. In the case of this, I thought what he really needed to do was to step back into rather more old-fashioned filmmaking. I mean, Dante Spinotti, brilliant, you know, no doubt about it, but just the digital thing didn't, for me, marry the subject matter. So, not enough Marianne Cotillard, essentially shot in the wrong format, and nothing like as deep in its central thesis of the two blokes of the same side of the two sides of a coin as Michael Mann's other films. So as a Michael Mann film, I went, huh. As a cinema fan, I went, huh. Because, in an age in which Michael Bay and Brett Ratner and McGee are making all this money, at least Michael Mann has made something that looks like it might be a hit.
Dear Harry Draco Snape, and various other Harry Potter references. And hello to David Morrissey. Harry Potter says Hermione on this text.
Yeah.
That's suspicious.
Already.
Why wasn't Peter Jackson asked to direct one of the Harry Potter films? Very excited, as I mentioned earlier, Harry Potter and the Tommy Hearsblood Prince being screened later today.
That's very good.
Exciting.
Yeah, you're going to see it. I'm not.
I think Peter Jackson would have been fantastic, would have been great, maybe would have won an Oscar. It would have been something else, wouldn't it?
Peter it would. Jackson, I mean, if we go right back to the beginning of all this, you remember that Terry Gilliam was at one point in the frame to direct the first Harry Potter movie, which of course he didn't, that ended up being done by Chris Columbus. And of course, I mean, my suspicion is Peter Jackson would have just been too busy. I mean, Guillermo del Toro is somebody else who I would love to have seen do a Harry Potter movie, because he has that same kind of fairy tale sensibility, very, very dark sensibility, which I like.
Andy and Barry, dear Holden and Banky, having just seen Michael Mann's latest output in the cinema, I can't deny it, I liked it, but left with an empty feeling of why didn't I like it more?
Well, there we go.
The plot was good, the acting top class, we can actually understand Christian Bale for once, but I just had a solemn feeling of emptiness.
Yeah. That, funnily enough, that in just those couple of sentences said exactly what I was saying when I rambled on for about 5 minutes.
Took you 20 minutes to say what he said in a text.
Yeah, but he said that he didn't know, he wasn't quite sure why, and I hope that what I did was explained why.
George in
that
Leeds.
That being my job.
Dear Marks and Engels was looking forward to Public Enemies.
I am definitely Marks and you are definitely Engels. You are definitely Engels.
And what makes me Engels?
Because I've got a bigger head and hair than you have.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah. Mark's got a huge head. Have you been to his grave?
Didn't Trotsky have the biggest hair?
Well, it was sort of a mad hair. Yeah.
He also got an ice pick.
Yes, that made his ears burn.
Was looking forward to Public Enemies for ages, but my experience was spoilt by people talking all the way through. It all felt quiet, apart from the shooting. And the sound of people saying things like, ha ha, he's smoking. The demise of a major character stopped me from feeling totally immersed. I blame Michael Bay and others. Audiences have become so used to not really caring about what goes on in front of them that they've forgotten that movies can be about things worth becoming emotionally involving. Also, is it just me or is it hard to make things out when the high-def camera pans round?
No, it is true. Funnily enough, high-def does a weird thing that it leaves a kind of, almost like a halo behind it. There's a slight digital smudge that they haven't sorted out yet. I mean, I wasn't sure whether it was on purpose, but there is still no substitute for shooting on celluloid.
The only other decent movie title with a tennis-related theme from Paul in Northern Ireland who contributes, Black Hawk Eye Down, which we haven't had. And I don't think 101 Nalbandians actually makes it, Robin Enfield.
But no, I like that. I don't even know what Nalbandian is.
David Nalbandian, Argentine tennis
player. I think 101 Nalbandians is the best
one. That one.
I do. And
better
I don't
than
know.
The Roger Cook.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 101. Yeah, no, that's funnier. Because it's pithy.
Rob, you appear to have won. So 101 Nalbandians is where we are. Well, look, we've got a couple of minutes. It's men's semi-final day. We've got Roger Federer, Tommy Haas out very, very shortly. What else can we
just very quickly mention a few things. Strawberry and Chocolate, which is being re-released as part of the Cine Cuba season. It's a 1995 Oscar-nominated Cuban film. I have to confess I hadn't seen it before, but it's very, very highly regarded, from Tomas Gutierrez Alea. And it's the story about two young men meeting in a park. One of them has absolutely impeccable political credentials. The other is a sort of free-thinking gay artist with a strange religious fixation. Together, they develop a relationship. One appears to be spying on the other, but in fact, it blossoms into something more than that. I mean, it was a really, really nice, heartwarming, proper film about in which people sit around, discuss issues of sexuality, gender, politics, and art. And I understand that, consequently, that means that you're probably not going to rush to see it. But in the midst of all the Transformers and things, I liked it very much, and it was good to see this part of the Cine Cube season. Two
is
horror
Megan
films.
Is Megan Fox
She's
in
not.
It?
Megan Fox is not in it at any point at all. And I didn't even do the Megan Fox thing then, because I can't be bothered anymore. Two horror films to mention. There is a horror film out called Red Mist, which is fairly disappointing. A fair bunch of people mistreat somebody who then goes into a coma, and then his spirit comes out of the hospital bed and commits various acts of problematic atrocity. I mean, the most obvious
problematic
thing...
Problematic atrocity, is
yeah, you know, scrungy killing.
As opposed to atrocities that are
non-problematic,
okay,
yeah.
Really.
The thing that bothered me about it, quite apart from the fact that it's incredibly sort of, yes, we have seen all this before and everyone's doing accents and yada-da-da-da, is, in fact, that is the plot of Legion, is that there's somebody, you know, they can't get out of the place, but their spirit is going out, infesting other people. It's also, funnily enough, this part of the plot of Hidden to some extent. So it's a very, very old, hackneyed horror plot, rehashed in sort of fairly unremarkable fashion. There is also this thing out called The Embodiment of Evil, which is this Brazilian horror film. The third part of the Coffin Joe series, which is has been going for an awfully long time. It follows on from At Midnight I'll Take Your Soul from 1964 and This Night I'll Possess Your Corpse from 1967. And it is remarkable only for the fact that it sees the return of Jose Mojica Marins. And it is one of those films in which, when watching it, even I, as a hardened horror fan, went, yucky poo. You know, blimey. I mean...
It was too yucky for you.
No, I thought, I mean, there were points in which I thought, okay, I might be offended by the old sort of tortury stuff, and it's incredibly leery in the way of Jess Franco movies, and I mean, really, you know, gender politics don't even enter into it, but there were moments in it I just thought,
so
but
movie,
in a funny way.
Yeah, our movie of the week?
Well, clearly Public Enemies, but it's still a disappointment.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.